From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we kick off our Project Milwaukee series on clean water by asking if we need to redefine our image of pure.
Think of the Mississippi River. It starts up in Itasca, Minnesota. People pull it for drinking water. Wastewater treatment puts it back into that river. It flows down the river. Other cities pull it. They're treating water that's been used.
Later, why Governor Tony Evers has declared 2019 as the year of clean drinking water in Wisconsin.
We'll learn how perceptions affect whether people drink water from the tap.
And the joys of writing noir fiction using Milwaukee as the city that never sleeps.
They're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits. And noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. We begin our week-long Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes, Troubled Waters, on today's show. It's a series that asks the basic question, why is it a challenge to ensure clean water in a place that's adjacent to an enormous supply of it?
But we begin the series with two even more fundamental questions. Just what do we mean by clean water? And is it something we can really hope to achieve?
Lake Effect's Susan Benz went in search of answers to those questions. She spoke with Patrick McNamara, an assistant professor of civil construction and environmental engineering at Marquette University.
McNamara's lab focuses on understanding how chemicals from consumer products affect public health and the environment once they go down the drain and through treatment plants. He considered the basic questions we had.
Do we have clean water, or why is it not clean? To me, carries the presumption that it's not clean. And I think it really depends on your perspective and what you want to use it for. And we have a lot of different water locations, right? Kewaunee County is different from Milwaukee County, is different from Waukesha. But when I think about, do we have clean water here in the Milwaukee area in Wisconsin, I think about a context relative to time and to geography in the world. So if you go back to 1993, when we had a catastrophic outbreak in Milwaukee, people died. A lot of people got sick. Do we have clean water? Then the answer was unequivocally no. We do not have clean water. And if you ask people then, do we have clean water? They couldn't turn on their tap without getting sick. I was not living in Milwaukee at the time, and you would be able to correct me on this, but I heard that the way they found out there was an issue is all the drugstores were running out of their stomach medicine and Pepto-Bismol, and that they traced it back then to the water. So this was a real citywide problem. So if you compare Milwaukee now to Milwaukee then, do we have clean water? Yeah, I live in Milwaukee County. I can turn on my tap. I have a 3-year-old, a 1.5-year-old. I give them water from the tap. We don't give bottled water. So they're not going to get cryptosporidium. In fact, because of that outbreak, Milwaukee now has one of the most advanced drinking water treatment plants in the country. So we say there's conventional drinking water treatment. There's normal steps. Well, Milwaukee goes beyond conventional. First, they pull from very deep into Lake Michigan. It's a big water source. They pull from deep in there. It's different than pulling from a shallow river or lake. And then they pre-treat all their water with ozone. That's an advanced treatment process. And then they put their water through the normal drinking water distribution system that other cities use. So we have ozone. We pull from Lake Michigan. So are we pulling and treating, providing clean water? Yes, especially compared to 1993. Do we have taps that we can drink from? Yes. And if we compare to other developing countries or regions, some locations where rivers are where they wash their clothes, where they have to use the bathroom, where they have to pull for drinking water, they don't have separate wastewater drinking water treatment systems. It feels like it's just a right, and we take it for granted that we have wastewater. But globally, that's not true. So imagine if we did not have Jones Island wastewater treatment plant. Where would all that wastewater go that we flush? What would happen to it? We treat it, we concentrate it, and sometimes there's odors that you smell in the fifth ward. And that's as bad as it gets, is that sometimes there's some odors, as opposed to all the diseases of untreated wastewater that can go around. So we have this water resource, but over time our population is growing. And so we're using this water more and more. And just because water's been used once doesn't mean it's bad. right? So we can measure things in it. There's bacteria or cryptosporidium. We can look for that and know it's not there, regardless of what's been used in the past, right? We can treat it to use it. So think of astronauts, right? They're not bringing a lake with them out there. So they're doing the most intense, direct, potable reuse, right? They excrete water, they treat it, they drink it. So there's this thought of toilet to tap. I don't like it. It's dirty. We've already been doing it for a long time. So think of the Mississippi River. It starts up in Itasca, Minnesota. People pull it for drinking water. Wastewater treatment puts it back into that river. It flows down the river. Other cities pull it. They're treating water that's been used, right? But we have regulations and technologies to do this. It's what we do in Milwaukee. We reuse our own water. Jones Island discharges to Lake Michigan. It's treated, right? Goes into the lake. We pull from Lake Michigan. This is what every city does. They discharge and pull from similar sources of water. So we're going to reuse it. So it's not whether it's been used or not that makes it clean or dirty. It's what's in the water. If you use it and don't clean it, right? If a dog or an animal, you know, excretes into this water, it's dirty. So if you don't treat it, it's dirty.
Talk a little bit how your research fits into this water story.
Yeah, so we've been researching both wastewater and drinking water, and there's this research field in general uses the phrase one water. So in the past, we used to say, oh, there's wastewater, and that's separate from drinking water. But now we've realized everything is one water. So what we treat in wastewater goes into Lake Michigan, goes into the drinking water plants. We drink it, or we use it at our house, it goes down the drain and it goes back. And so you'll see people are researching both. So we have some research on drinking water pipes and what's in our pipes and what bacteria are in our pipes and how do the different corrosion inhibitors affect bacteria that are in the pipes. And we have research on wastewater and looking at different bacteria that might be in the wastewater treatment plant. And we look at superbugs. These are the bugs that fight back against all the antibiotics. So when you go to the doctor, you have a flu, they don't prescribe antibiotics because antibiotics don't work against a virus. And the more we use antibiotics, the less effective they become. And that's really a big public health concern, that antibiotics are becoming less effective because there's more of these quote-unquote superbugs or ones that fight back against antibiotics. And we study wastewater because that's kind of your hot spot for all the bacteria in the city. All the antibiotics get flushed down. So that's essentially the stomach of the city of Milwaukee. And so we're looking at superbugs and bacteria in these treatment plants.
If we're going to add a cushion of protection, is it through regulation? Is it through funding research? Is it both or something else?
There's a lot of good organizations like the Sea Grant organization that funds research that's all built on protecting Lake Michigan, the Great Lakes around here. There's research out of Sandra McClellan's lab that looks at E. coli and fecal indicators on the beaches that get into Lake Michigan. And so they are tracking, and if there's ever going to be a problem, they will know it faster than anyone. People come to them to find out problems. So as long as there's active monitoring and research on the beaches, the lake, the drinking water, the wastewater, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District is actually very progressive in that they have a research program and they track bacteria contaminants, they track chemical contaminants, and they track technologies to remove these chemicals. So we are fortunate to have universities in the city with research platforms, UWM and Marquette, that are monitoring the water here. And so it is a benefit to have a big urban city with a lot of infrastructure, research lab capabilities. So from a personal perspective, you can call your utility. You could even call Sandra McClellan's lab and ask her, and people are happy to talk. As a society, what do we need to do? We can't put our head in the sand and ignore it. We have to just monitor and be on the forefront for viruses, for bacteria, for antibiotic resistance, for chemicals, and develop technologies in the lab to understand when there might be problems. So it's our job to monitor this water. You know, we go to school for a long time to be able to run these experiments, and if we're not doing that, we're not doing our job. So fortunately, there are people like Sandra and Brooke Mayer that are out there studying and understanding our water.
Is there an area of research that you feel, or a contaminant that's raises the most concern for you, either as a researcher, as a parent, as a citizen?
I think viruses will become more studied. You know, my kids lost a lot of time at daycare from being sick this year, and it was often from viruses, and bacteria can't treat them. And we haven't studied viruses that much because they were harder to detect. And in science, the analogy is kind of like looking for your keys at night with streetlights. You only look where the light is shining, and if you lose them in the dark, you don't look at these other dark spots. And so we find what we can detect. But now technology is improving, methods are getting better, and people are starting to research viruses. And as that causes some people to get sick, I think we will study more about them, where they are, where they go, how to treat them, how to monitor them.
Patrick McNamara is an assistant professor of civil construction and environmental engineering at Marquette University. He spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz.
Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water in the state. We'll find out why he believes it's such a priority when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tens of thousands of people across Wisconsin say they don't trust the water that comes out of their taps thanks to lead pipes, agricultural runoff, or industrial pollution.
Governor Evers has declared 2019 the year of clean drinking water and included $70 million in his budget to address water quality. But some Republican legislators say too much of that money would go to Milwaukee to remove lead water lines and neglect other areas of the state.
WUWM's Latoya Dennis spoke with Governor Evers for this installment of our Project Milwaukee series, Great Lakes Troubled Waters, about why now was the time to focus on clean water.
We want to focus a lot of our efforts and provide as many financial resources as possible to make sure that people feel safe in the water they drink. And it's a statewide issue, obviously. In northern Wisconsin, they're concerned about it, and southeast Wisconsin. So it's something we feel very strongly about, and includes issues around lead pipes and how that impacts young people. So it's a broad issue.
Now, you said you want to devote a number of financial or a lot of financial resources to this, but you don't necessarily have a legislature here on board with that. How do you handle that?
Well, we'll continue to fight. I mean, it does concern me, and it should concern your listeners too. When people say, "Geez, we don't think it's fair that we're putting all this money to the urban areas so that we can get the lead out of the pipes in Milwaukee or other urban areas because it doesn't impact us out of state." Well, who can be against or who can be for having kids drinking water that has lead in it? I just think that's a really short-sighted view. So we're going to continue to take this to the public and making sure that they're active in this this budget. It is a people's budget, and people in Wisconsin want to make sure that they can drink their water safely, and it should not be a Republican or Democratic issue.
Now, to be clear, though, this isn't just about lead pipes in Milwaukee. I mean, when you get to rural areas and even some suburban Milwaukee areas, there are problems with, you know, farm runoff and urban runoff.
Absolutely. And we are putting we're putting significant resources in to make sure that not only we have ways of fixing lead service lines, but also make sure that we focus our efforts on targeting runoff management that impacts our suburban people and rural people in the state of Wisconsin, and also invest in different infrastructure practices that will reduce that non-point type of pollution that we see because of different agricultural enterprises. So yes, we're making a great effort there. It is going to take more than 1 year. It's going to take people valuing having safe drinking water, and I know they do. So it's convincing the legislature of the importance.
Now, you know, I want to touch on something, a couple of things you just said, but the first, that it's going to take more than 1 year. When people hear, you know, that this is the year of clean drinking water, I think some people might say, oh, so in a year's time, these won't be issues anymore.
Well, it is going to take longer than that. I mean, we have people that across Wisconsin and even in southeast Wisconsin that need to, because of polluted water and polluted because of any number of reasons, have to re-drill their wells or change their wells or go deeper, and we're providing money for that. But that will take time. I mean, we're focusing now to shine the light on it, but it will take obviously more than a year. And we have to value that going forward. It can't be just, well, we're going to fix wells. We're going to make sure that the runoff is contained. We're making sure that we have the good instruments in place to monitor runoff and pollution. But that is something that's going to be ongoing.
And what do you mean when you say, or you said something to the effect of people need to value clean water more?
Well, because it hasn't happened. I mean, I'll use the issue of lead pipes as an example. That's been in place for several years, the knowledge that that it impacts kids in a pretty dramatic way. So I think, you know, what I learn and what we should learn from our tribal nations in the state, that they have a cultural and spiritual respect for making sure that the water stays clean. And we value it, and that hasn't always been the case.
But when you say that, are you talking about members of the general public? Are you talking about elected officials?
Oh, everybody. I mean, clearly, people are struggling with these issues in their homes. And so, yes, we want to make sure that people are demanding that we provide these resources to make sure that they have clean water. But it is, you know, at the end of the day, these decisions will be made in this bubble that we call the Capitol, and we have to make sure that people understand how important it is. It's not just around large farms. It's not just around issues of industrial or agricultural pollution, or even most recently with the PFAS that we're finding now are contaminating our water. All these, so it's going to be an ongoing process, and we just have to, once we get to the point, and I think we're almost there, that people value the our history of having clean water in the state, it will become less of a political issue and more of a common sense issue.
What makes you think we're almost there?
Well, because I haven't, except for this issue of lead pipes in Milwaukee, we haven't got much pushback from the legislature. So I believe at the end of the day, we will be able to start this process of providing the resources necessary to keep our wells safe and to keep our municipal water system safe, and to engage in practices, whether they're industrial, agricultural, or whatever, that that we protect water. A small example of this, and it is a concern that actually we're beginning to make people understand that high capacity wells actually have an influence on clean water in this state. So it's changing the mindset, and I think we're in a good position by starting out with this being the year of clean drinking water.
Why do you think you're receiving so much, or there's so much pushback to Milwaukee getting money for the lead pipes?
Well, I think it's an issue of that legislators need to protect their home turf, and they decide that if Milwaukee gets money, then they don't. I like to view it as kids are drinking water that has lead in it, and let's fix it, and no matter where it happens. So it's a constant issue between outstate and Milwaukee area, southeast Wisconsin legislators. But at the end of the day, we have to put that aside.
What if the money is not appropriated? How do you move forward?
Well, I think it will be appropriated. I'm confident of that. Also, it's important for us to recognize that we have to have science be at the basis of all these decisions. And that hasn't been the case in the past. So we're making sure that our scientists at the DNR are on board with this issue, and they're actively engaged in it. We're actually seeking more money to create more issues around safe water, both in our Department of Natural Resources and in our Department of Agriculture.
What do you say to those families or those people who are afraid to turn on their tap and drink from it or give that water to their children?
Well, help is on the way, but if their water is inadequate now, either from nitrates or from lead or any other issue, they should be rattling the cages of their municipal officials to get some clean water to their homes. It's not something that we want to wait on. So if parents are concerned about the water, they should have it tested and they should be seeking remediation. And in the meantime, making sure that the municipality helps getting bottled water there if they have to. That's what's happened in parts of northern Wisconsin with the polyfluoride issue, where it's getting into the drinking water, and the companies that put that there, put it underground, is paying for the water. That is a remedial thing. We shouldn't be allowing that to happen to begin with, but if parents are concerned, they should be working with their local government to make sure that they have access to clean water in their home.
And you just mentioned individual municipalities, right? I am wondering what the role is when it comes to the federal government, the state, and then those individual municipalities. Like, whose job is it to do what?
Well, I think at the end of the day, clean water is a statewide issue in the state of Wisconsin. So I believe we have a major responsibility. Certainly, municipalities are in charge of different pieces. They have the sewage systems and they have the water delivery systems there. But if we want safe water across the state of Wisconsin, I believe we do have an obligation. I also believe the federal government needs to be working on this issue also. The Great Lakes is a good example. They span several states, and I'm having the pleasure, actually, of chairing the Great Lakes governors and premiers. There's a couple provinces in Canada that border the Great Lakes that they will be coming to Milwaukee this summer and having a meeting in June talking about these very issues. So it's an international issue. It's a federal issue. But I think states and municipalities, and states in particular, if we want this to be a state where people want to live and move to, we have to make sure we have clean water.
Governor Tony Evers has earmarked $70 million in his state budget to begin fixing water quality issues across the state. His budget faces an uphill battle with a Republican state legislature. Evers spoke with WUWM's LaToya Dennis.
Another break now, and then we'll try to understand how people decide whether to drink the water that comes from their tap. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The issue of lead in drinking water isn't limited to low-income neighborhoods around Milwaukee. The housing stock and the water infrastructure in many city and suburban neighborhoods is old, and lead laterals serve modest houses and sprawling mansions alike.
But how do people around the city decide whether to drink water straight from the tap, run it through a filter, drink bottled water, or some other option? We sent Lake Effect intern Zoe Munson out into the field to get a sample of what people choose and why.
I know I was in Peru this summer, and everything has to be filtered. The showers are filtered, the faucet water is filtered. A lot of people even filter their water before they boil it. And so in comparison to a lot of other countries, I think that Milwaukee in the U.S., is pretty stable when it comes to water, but we definitely have a lot we need to work on.
Like, I have concerns with public water versus I usually use filtered water, and I have concerns about what's in my water as well. Honestly, I need to be more educated about the subject. For now, I just drink my reverse osmosis water and hope that all is well. I've heard we have clean water here in Milwaukee compared to, say, Chicago, but I honestly don't know. I have not done the research to find out whether we do actually drink clean water here.
In my neighborhood, anyway, the houses were built in late 50s, so our pipes are okay. And other places I've traveled to have far worse problems. So So in Ballant, I think our water is clean.
Lake Effect intern Zoe Munson collected our interviews from around Milwaukee. Researchers are also increasingly interested in how people decide whether to drink their tap water. That's true in places like Milwaukee and Flint, but also in places where there are fewer concerns about lead.
Greg Pierce is the Associate Director of Research at the Luskin Center for Innovation at the University of California, Los Angeles, and he studies public perceptions of tap water. We reached him on the line from California. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Give us some context for the question that you have dug into. What made you interested in this question of perception of tap water in the first place?
Yeah, I think, there's multiple things. Really focusing more broadly on water quality and water safety in multiple different contexts. But really since Flint, there's been an interest both from the public and from the researcher perspective on digging deeper into questions of water quality, perception and sort of detection of water quality that goes beyond what the federal regulations sort of lay out in the Safe Drinking Water Act. The more I dug into the issue of mistrust of the tap, began to realize that some of the work, including some of my own early work on this issue, really characterized mistrust as something that was irrational or based on experiences or individual factors. But the more I've done this work, seen that it appears people are making more rational decisions than we expected based on the quality of the water that's coming out of their tap, which isn't easy to observe as researchers or even as regulators, but is something that people are experiencing and making decisions on that affects both their health and welfare.
What do we understand about how people made these decisions before Flint?
Yeah, I think there were certainly there's different sources around just basically asking people what they perceive about their water quality, whether it's safe to drink, whether they drink it. But very little of that was actually tied to whether the water that was coming out of the tap was unsafe or unclean, whether they were served by different types of water systems. And most of the research concluded, and I still think there's some role here, that a lot of the mistrust of the tap was driven actually by socioeconomic factors and by sort of personal risk assessment rather than anything to do with the water. Since, some others have done research on particularly urban areas, we found that, again, that there's actually more going on to the story.
What were the kinds of socioeconomic factors that originally played into this, even before people had Flint on their radar?
Certainly, well, education, more educated people tend to trust tap water, all else equal, as well as race and ethnicity, with particularly low levels of trust in tap water among low-income immigrants to this country who may have had particularly negative experiences with tap water in their home country, as well as lower trust in tap water among African-Americans, even in cases, in some cases where, the tap water is perfectly safe.
Well, so we're talking to you from Milwaukee, which has dealt with a lot of the same issues as people in the city of Flint. How has Flint been a game changer, if you will, in how people perceive their water quality and the kinds of actions they take because of that perception?
I mean, I guess off the top, certainly the polling that's come out and the various surveys that have been done since Flint have seemed to demonstrate a much higher level of both awareness, which in some ways is a positive, but also mistrust in the tap. That's been, I'd say, higher levels of mistrust, particularly in the Midwest around Flint, as well as among the African-American population, given the way that decision-making around addressing the crisis in Flint was targeted or sort of neglected because of the majority African-American population in that city. At the same time, we still don't have great data that would allow us to sort of systematically characterize the long-term effect on perception. It's too certain to tell, I would say, outside of Michigan and outside of the Midwest, how much of a long-term impact this is going to have on mistrust. But it seems to be quite relevant still.
Well, and so what are the implications for public health or the environment when people choose to drink something besides their tap water, even in places that might not be dealing with the same issues as Flint or Milwaukee?
So there's a lot of concern, particularly from the public health perspective, but also from, sort of social welfare perspective, regardless of the cause of mistrust, whether it's misperception or whether it's lead in the water, around people not trusting the tap and then first drinking more bottled water or sugary beverages, which cost on the order of around 500 times more per unit of the beverage than the tap water. So having to spend upwards of $1,000 a year as opposed to, you know, a few hundred dollars a year for tap water as opposed to these beverages, as opposed to bottled beverages. The health impacts are multiple. There's certainly a concern, I would say sort of a lower level concern around dental health if you're drinking either bottled water or sugary beverages, but more so the concern around diabetes and reliance on sugary beverages because the cost is relatively similar to bottled water. That's causing obesity and other sorts of long-term health effects. There's also stress and sort of indignity effects on people who don't trust their own tap water, aren't able to trust their own tap water. Then there's environmental externalities of both the bottled water and bottled sugary beverage use, as well as water systems receive sort of less revenue and less public confidence when people don't trust the tap. So there's really a manifold range of impacts, negative impacts from mistrust.
This is a really tricky equation, though, in a place like Flint or a place like Milwaukee, when people might be looking at sugary beverages or bottled water versus tap water as a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation.
Yeah, and I'd say also, I would say there's no evidence in most cases that bottled water or sugary beverages are safer, even in terms of the water quality, than your average tap water. But when it comes to lead in the tap water, you do have to, in those emergency cases, rely on bottled water. It's still, you know, the argument for sugary beverages is not as strong, but yes, there's no other choice at that point.
So if you're a city or you're a municipal water supplier, is some of this a message issue? Do cities and their water utilities have to do a better job of making the case that the water they're providing to their citizens is safe to drink?
There's a very fine line. In cases where the water isn't safe, particularly when there's lead in the water, it's not an issue of messaging except to tell people you can't drink the water and really then make the case to the city at large or the state or in some cases the federal government, which still hasn't seemed to get the message, that we just need a lot more funding to address, when there's lead in the service lines. You need a lot of money to switch them out. That's the bottom line. Anything else is a short-term fix that won't really address the problem. But in cases where the water is safe and people mistrust, it is a matter of messaging. But it's a matter of, I think, doing more aggressive and more nuanced messaging than water systems and public health agencies have done to date, and really trying to combat the false claims that many bottled water and sugary beverage companies are putting out there about the tap. So I think that's where nonprofits and advocacy groups have to come in, because public agencies just aren't in a position or comfortable with doing a sort of an ad campaign to the extent that they would need.
Right. It's interesting because, you know, we're having this conversation in the Midwest, and there's a lot of this old housing stock and these lead lateral lines, which are causing real problems. You do a lot of your work in California, and the perception problem is it sounds like a completely different issue out there.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, how I got really motivated to keep doing this work is the fact that if you look at the one national source of data on tap water perception, Los Angeles and San Bernardino Riverside, which is the metro areas with the two highest levels of mistrust in the tap water, even though we have virtually no lead issues and most of the water that's being delivered to those communities is technically safe per the federal and state standards, there's still a lot going on with the sort of distribution lines of the various water systems and the premise plumbing or the water pipes within buildings that it does appear, as we do more and more with this research, is leading to contamination that causes people to think the water is unsafe and is sort of a rational response to mistrust that water. So that's where the messaging and further investment in those parts of infrastructure becomes necessary.
As a researcher, do you have occasion to just sit down with people and talk to them about how they make these decisions, get kind of anecdotal data as well?
Yeah, so we are now doing a lot of work in particular communities in Los Angeles, and I should say These issues are particularly concentrated in low-income, disadvantaged communities in urban Los Angeles. And so we do work with residents, with community groups who are working on these issues, both to better understand sort of how they're perceiving their tap water, how they're making choices, but also, you know, to help inform solutions that will work for them and won't place the burden entirely on them just changing their minds in cases where they have brown water coming out of the tap.
Well, and so as we look at a place like Milwaukee or a place like Flint or any other community that's had this kind of significant issue with lead, once that, and this is a, you know, this is a big if and a big when, once that issue is corrected, there is still going to be, one imagines, a pretty significant effort needed by the community to convince its people that that the water is, again, safe to drink.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, where we're going with this research, and there are some others doing parallel research as well, is really trying to understand the segments of sort of mistrust. And I think there's inevitably going to be a segment of people who just will never go back to the tap once they've heard about the lead issue and had a really negative experience, or, you know, maybe had determined that there is lead in their water. But there's a whole other group somewhere in the middle that may be convincible if we take, you know, more, again, more aggressive and more sort of informative and you know, targeted messages that convey with confidence that the water is safe, but don't get too complex at the same time. And that's where the education piece of water quality, given that it is a science, there's a very fine line between giving people too much information or too little that I think we all need to work on to help people feel confident.
It's a complicated bunch of issues.
It is. But, yeah, I think one, again, that since Flint has come onto the scene and other incidents really across the Midwest, Northeast, and somewhat in the Southeast of this country has become, you know, paramount that we work on.
Well, Greg Pierce, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Greg Pierce is the Associate Director of Research at the Luskin Center for Innovation at UCLA. You'll find a link to his research about public perceptions of tap water quality at WUWM.com.
One last break, and then we'll talk with several of the writers featured in the new short story collection, Milwaukee Noir. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
We are back with Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Noir exposes the underbelly of a place. In film or fiction, characters live in the shadows, denizens of a night where every good intention is punished. Noir found its natural home in New York City and L.A. in the 1940s and 50s, but now Milwaukee can lay claim to its own piece of the genre.
Milwaukee Noir is a collection of 14 short stories edited by our next guest, Tim Hennessy. Two of the writers, Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin, joined Tim in the studio as well as he explains how the project began.
About 3 years ago, a friend of mine, Scott Phillips, was editing the St. Louis Noir anthology, and he had been in town and we met for coffee. And we were talking about projects that he was working on, and he had asked what I was working on. And at that time, really nothing was working. And he had said, oh, they're looking to do a Milwaukee one. I could mention you. And I thought, oh, that's amazing. But why would they possibly consider me? I do book reviews, and I do interviews, and I also am a bookseller. And my short fiction wasn't really kind of finding a home. So it seemed like a little bit of an unlikely matching to me. But he did reach out, and they were very interested, but their slate was full at the time. So I did mostly researching for a year, finding different authors I thought would lend themselves well to the project. And I wanted to incorporate a lot of different voices. So I was looking at journalists. I was looking at poets. I was looking at really anyone who could lend a really authentic sense of Milwaukee and what it's like to live here.
And it had to be new work, right?
Yes. All of it had to be first-time published work. And that was part of the challenge.
Okay. And how did you meet these two?
I was big fans of their work. I found both their books while working at Half Price Books. And it was just a matter of, you know, sometimes you're either getting a book in or you're shelving it and you think, oh, wow. And but then seeing a Milwaukee connection, they definitely were people I looked deeper into their work and really fell in love with it. So they were you know, right away people I wanted to have involved.
Now, Jennifer, once you heard about it, did you want to do this or was there any resistance?
I have a policy to, if I'm physically capable of saying yes, I will say yes. That is my, you know, my message to the universe. If I get a writing invitation, I will try to say yes. I am not a noir writer by nature. I'm a happy ending, can't we all get along kind of person. So the idea of writing a story, and I'm thinking noir is like, you know, Raymond Chandler and the, you know, the gritty private investigator, mysterious dame walks into his office and he's, you know, polishing off a bottle of whiskey, you know.
I just think Humphrey Bogart, you know, when yeah. I hear noir, that's what I think.
Yeah. And you know, so I wanted to be open to that, but I had to set some rules for myself about how I would approach this new genre. But I definitely wanted to say yes, so I did. And my two rules were I was going to write queer noir. I was going to bring in some kind of gay or trans theme into it. And the other one was no guns. And I often write about children. And so somebody suggested, well, you could have a water gun fight. You know, that would be fun, a little squirt gun thing. So I did work that in. But then the story really demanded a gun. So there is a gun.
But so you broke one of your rules.
I broke one of my rules. But that's part of learning to write a new genre.
And Valerie, had you any experience with noir writing before this?
Not exactly, although my first novel did have a crime element. So, I mean, it wasn't something that was completely alien to me, but I guess I would have thought of myself as more of a sort of literary fiction writer. And I didn't have that much experience even reading noir. So the first thing I did when Tim contacted me was I just went out and bought some of those noirs from other cities, like Boston Noir, New York Noir, that sort of thing. And I thought, well, I could try that, and I thought it would be fun. The good news was that also Tim contacted us in the summer, I think, and I teach during the academic year, and so I'm always more inclined to say yes to things in the summer. I'm like, oh, sure, I have all summer. This will only take a weekend or so. I can write that story in 2 days.
Was that true?
No, I worked on it for like 6 months. I finished it like a day before the deadline in December or January, I can't remember. But there was one little kernel of an idea that I had been kicking around for a short story before Tim contacted me. And so when he contacted me, I thought, well, I could use that kernel for this story. And the kernel was that there's a manhole in the middle of my garage. And I've always wondered what it leads to and why it's there and what's down there. It's always kind of scared me a little bit. Every time I get out of my car, I step on it and it makes that rattly sound. And so my story ended up kind of following what happens down that manhole.
Tim, did you think of noir and Milwaukee together easily?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Why? What is it about Milwaukee and its environs that lends itself to the noir genre so well?
We have such a rich history, and it's always amazed me and fascinated me. And we have the socioeconomical conditions where there's so much conflict. Everywhere there is conflict in the city. I used to be a cable guy, so all day long I was traveling throughout neighborhoods, throughout the city and the suburbs, so I constantly got to be in a lot of places and a lot of homes no one ever had access to. And you'd be inserted into conflicts and situations that a lot of times you're walking into the middle of a family during a crisis and they just happen to be getting cable. And so getting to see a lot of different neighborhoods really opened my eyes to the possibilities of just location. And certainly in my own work, I was always trying to figure out how to insert different aspects of different areas I'd see or different backgrounds and different economic classes. And there was never a lack of opportunity. And we have such a distinct culture here that I think goes ignored too often. And we don't often find anything in the city really or even in the state represented in fiction that much. So that was something I was really excited to do. And certainly, I mean, we've got a lot of history of problems that keep rising up again and again. So that's always something thematic that crime fiction really draws on, is just how you kind of can't escape the past so much. Something bad happened in the past, and it sometimes can have reverberations to the future.
Well, often do. Yeah, yeah. You know, the idea that it just plays out into generations. I probably should have started with this question. What does noir mean to the two of you, the two writers? I mean, Tim's kind of described it for himself, but the two writers who are representing all of the rest of the writers in the book, Jennifer, what is noir?
I think it's darkness. I think it's about finding the underside of daily life. You know, I did go back. I did my research. I do my homework. I'm a good student. So, you know, I did go and read some Raymond Chandler. I read Patricia Highsmith. You know, I'm trying to go to the roots of the genre. And it feels to me that any story can be noir if you're looking at the underside of it, the shadow side, the dark side. And I'm really, really interested in complicated characters who are not, they're not bad people, but they make bad choices or they have bad habits. And noir is great for that. So that's what I was looking for, is how do I show a protagonist who's a good person, who means to do right, but just messes everything up.
I was going to say, the thing I love about noir is that no one is perfect. You know, right. There's no perfection here. It's like everyone has something.
Yeah, the baseline right. assumption is that things are going to go wrong, that people commit crimes, that people are violent, right? In normal, I think in non-noir fiction, the assumption is these are more or less regular people and some bad things will happen to them. I think the assumption in noir is many of these people are bad. If you turn over a leaf, there will be something bad underneath it. Like the assumptions get reversed, right? The bad stuff, the crime, the violence, the darkness is assumed as a baseline. So there may be pockets of goodness buried in there, but I think that it's like the underworld.
Right. It's almost dystopian. Mm-hmm. In its outlook on life, there are these sparks of little brightness, but they get extinguished pretty quickly, you know?
And there's like a bigger tolerance for things like melodrama and like sleaziness, sexiness, cynical attitudes that I think kind of make it really fun to engage with both as a reader and as a writer.
Was it fun for the two of you to jump into this as writers?
Yeah, it was great fun because I now am talking with Tim about possibly doing a workshop at some point called Writing Dark, because it did change how I'm looking at my non-noir fiction. Anytime I learn something new about how to write is very exciting for me.
I was going to say, in a good way? Did it change it in a good way?
Yeah, it really opened me up to like, no, your characters are tough. They can handle a little more sleazy, sexy, whatever Valerie does, and the beautiful alliteration, you know, violence. I can hurt them more.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the resilience ends up showing more dimension, and the conflict just kind of really escalates things, too, because in a lot of noir fiction or just in crime fiction in general, you know, bad things happen, and then they get worse, and you can – there's a lot of tone range that you can take that. You can – you know, there's certainly a lot of comic noirs that use in comic crime stuff that really kind of just exaggerate those features. And then certainly the more dramatic ones that really just build on that and just bring the characters into a much worse spot than they started off.
I was going to say, and both of you kind of are in that latter. These stories are both in that latter category. And I'm hoping maybe each of you would read just a little bit. I don't want to give away each story. I want people to come and read them. Jennifer, you said you wanted to include queer and LGBT themes in yours. How did you do that?
Well, I feel like this story has two protagonists. I don't know if that's allowed in fiction. Maybe not. But there is the main character, Marta. She's our point of view character, is a gay Mexican-American woman from the South Side. Her cousin, who is known as Carlisa, joins the military, goes off to Afghanistan with the army, and comes back and announces to the family that she would like to be known as Carlos now and addressed as he. And so that was the way that I brought in tension that I feel in the Latino community around gay and trans identities.
And it brings a certain extra darkness to the story that you're telling because of these layers.
It does. Yeah. I like that layering of the precariousness of their lives, that it's not just that they're threatened by the outside world, but even within their family, there's a struggle to accept this evolving person.
Is there a paragraph that you would share with us?
I can read a little bit from Marta talking to her mom on the phone and trying to get her mom to use the right pronoun for Carlos. Carlos has disappeared, so Marta is looking for him. I called my mom from the street outside. Have you seen Carlos? She made the humming noise she always did before she lied or held something back. Today? No, mi amor, not since yesterday. Yesterday? When did you see him yesterday? More humming. Well, she went to talk to her mom and... You should say he, mommy. Well, they had a little talk, and then I don't know where she went. That's it? You have no idea where he is now? An icy feeling rushed down my spine. My mom could be evasive for a lot of reasons. Politeness, shyness with strangers, fear. She did it all the time. But this felt different. You could ask your tía. I'll do that. So throughout the story, Marta's trying to be the ambassador and say, we need to accept Carlos for who he is and how he wants to be addressed. And as the story progresses, the family unfortunately continues to fail to get the message. And Marta misses the message in her own ways, too.
Yes. Yeah, she's, again, we talk about that not, there's no perfection. She's not a perfect character either.
Right. Right?
Even though she's well-meaning.
Yeah.
So, Valerie, you have a very different setup. It takes place on the East Side, and that manhole cover figures into it.
Yeah, the story is narrated by a high school girl who's been living in the streets with a few friends of hers. So she's sort of homeless, and she's been given an assignment by one of her teachers to write a letter of appeal or complaint to a politician. And so the story itself is a letter to the mayor of Milwaukee. We shouldn't have been there in the first place. That's the problem with telling you anything real. We should have been tucked into soft little beds, dreaming of algebra or homecoming or whatever. We shouldn't have been creeping through the sewers under your city. I know that much. We shouldn't have been hunched up like rodents, sweeping our flashlights along the damp, scratchy walls, trying not to hit our heads while we searched for those metal rungs that lead up to manholes. Don't worry, I'm not talking about your real sewer system, Mr. Mayor, that deep channel of filth that flows down to Jones Island and fills up Lake Michigan. I'm talking about the old spiderweb of pipes that runs closer to the surface, under the East Side. Maybe you don't even know it exists, but we do. Me, Diego, and JJ, we drop down into it at night because some of those manholes don't open onto streets or alleys like you would expect. They open up into the garages of people like you. And people like you store all kinds of pawnable stuff in your garages, so much that you forget you ever even had it. I bet 9 out of 10 people we hit don't even know they've been robbed. So how bad am I really supposed to feel about it?
Terrific. Well, I want to thank all three of you for coming in this morning. This is great. And just thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tim Hennessy edited the short story collection Milwaukee Noir. Jennifer Morales and Valerie Lakin are two of the contributors to the collection.
The book launch happens Tuesday, May 7th at Boswell Books with most of the authors in attendance. You can find out more at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10. That's when we'll be live from the Cooperage in Milwaukee's Harbor District for a special live lake effect, part of our Great Lakes Troubled Waters Project Milwaukee series. That's Tuesday at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.